We'll be taking a look at your pet's health coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us as well with a question at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It is so nice to be back, Larry.
You've got all kinds of great little news stories for us. One about football games.
Yeah, there was an article published actually just this month in the AVMA Journal. And, you know, you just wonder how some of these things get funded. But, you know, it's just looking at statistics. And this was looking out east where the New England Patriots play. But they found that emergency visits during, you know, key games for them decreased significantly to the emergency room. So some of the theories are, you know, the people are watching and ignoring their pets. And so they thought, I wonder if right after the game's over, whether we see a increase in pets that have been like sitting and, you know, suffering for a while. And no, they didn't really see that. Then they started wondering, well, I wonder if it's because people are inside watching TV instead of outside hiking and cutting the lawn and having their dogs outside. Well, they didn't even look at that either. But they did find that, you know, when games are on and the whole thing came out, you know, the bottom line was you may want to look at decreasing your staffing of emergency clinics during key football games. So, you know, and that was a 3-page article in one of my journals. And I was like, oh, okay, you know. I think there's better things we can spend money on than looking at that. But, you know, that's so don't be, you know, if you have a pet that's sick, that might be the best time to go to the emergency clinic if you're not a football fan, because then you'll get individual attention.
That's a very, very good point. Well, what about this new canine influenza? What is it? H3N8?
Yes,
vaccine?
You know, and so it's similar to what we get, the H1N1, but this is the dog version. And we've known about this for several years now, and there have been outbreaks in some shelters and racetracks and so on where dogs are housed together. And for most dogs, it just presents as like a kennel cough-like symptom where they may be a little sick, they cough, and they get over it. But for some dogs, it can result in very severe, sometimes fatal pneumonia. And this new vaccine has come out. Unfortunately, it only has a conditional license, which means that there's still some testing to do, but they wanted to get this on the market just because, like, the same thing that we're seeing or potentially going to be seeing with people, we, you know, are anticipating that this may be something that's going to be happening in dogs because there is no natural immunity to this particular virus for dogs. The study's been done on 700 dogs and found it to be safe. I'm still going to sit back and wait a little bit longer since we're not quite in flu season yet where dogs are housed inside and go into kennels like over the holidays and so on, Christmas vacations and stuff. And we'll see how it does when it gets into the hands of the regular public. So
I wanted to bring one other thing up. We were going to talk about dog bites, but I wanted to just switch and talk for a minute about cat bites because cat bites can be serious too.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people will look at a cat bite and look at, you know, because dog bites tend to be very disfiguring. You go into the emergency clinic for those because they're usually, you know, facial or arm bites and, you know, significant tears and damage. Cat bites, they have those little teeth that are like needles and they may bite and it's going to hurt like the dickens, but people don't think about going in. There was a study done that found that 89, almost 90% of cats had Pasteurella in their mouth, which is the bacteria that causes that horrible infection from cat bites. And because this is given to us like via a needle, that like a little needle bite that tends to seal over, very common to get significant cellulitis, tissue damage. It's very deep. These need to be treated. You have to go into the clinic and get your cat bites treated, or it could result in some, you know, hospitalization and IV antibiotics and surgeries and so on. In fact, one of the ladies I work with at the front desk got bit and chose to ignore it, and she still has not regained full function of her hand. And she, this was her own cat that bit her, and she knows better, but she was busy and didn't go to the hospital and has already had 2 surgeries done on her hand and still doesn't have full function of her thumb. So there
when
you go.
When you go to an emergency room with something like that, they're going to, even though you can barely see
it, they're going to probably put you on an antibiotic. And it's usually pretty simple antibiotics. It's ones that most people tolerate. They're inexpensive and it can be a lifesaver. So, you know, don't disregard those. But make sure your cat's up to date on rabies because bite wounds will get reported to animal control. And if your cat is not up to date on rabies, then it may mean a quarantine period for them. So even indoor cats need to be vaccinated.
All right. Good points. Let's go to Karen in Portage, who has a question for you. Karen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a lab golden, and she has a habit which really fascinates me, puzzles me. Mm-hmm. I call it itch biting.
Okay.
She itch bites me. She itch bites her stuffed toys, and she will do this for an interminable amount of time.
Now, you're talking about the little nibbling that dogs do with their front teeth, kind of just with their incisors, and kind of bite on it. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So she does this with her toys, and she does this with you as well. And she is, you're not petting her at the time, which may be stimulating her to do this kind of thing. You're not hitting an itchy spot.
Nope,
you know how dogs scratch their,
She'll be playing with her stuffed toy, or we'll be playing, and the next thing she's lying down with it and just itch biting it for 2-3 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I have seen dogs do like more nursing behavior, especially if they were weaned really early or bottle fed. They may have some weird non-nutritional sucking behaviors, but this sounds very different, and I don't know why. Sometimes dogs, it becomes a learned effect. Maybe at one point she was doing that and you paid attention. You went, what are you doing to your stuffed toy? And you paid attention to her, you stopped what you were doing, and she learned, you do this and maybe good things will happen. And, you know, it's something as simple like that she may, you may have, inadvertently trained her to do this behavior. It doesn't sound like it is, you know, anything life-threatening. If it's not interfering with her ability to do other things, she's still eating, sleeping, playing, and so on, and you can distract her from it. It doesn't sound like it's a really severe compulsive disorder, which we do see in dogs, that may warrant, sometimes these, you know, dogs will have compulsive behaviors that we need to be looking at getting them on psychoactive drugs just so they can lead a normal life, because all they'll do is maybe chase their tail or, you know, rhythmically circle or do, really bizarre behaviors. So, what I would be doing is trying to redirect her to other things so that maybe when she's doing that to you, you can, you know, throw a frisbee, throw a ball, do something else to, keep her mind occupied. And maybe this is an indication that she is just not being kept active enough. You know, my little phrase, a tired dog's a well-behaved dog.
Yeah.
You know, you've got an active lab golden probably. And, you know, unless you're out walking or running, you know, miles a day, she may be really bored. And this is just one way of kind of, you know, solving that boredom problem. So,
all right. There you have it. Thanks a lot for calling, Karen. Appreciate it. Bev in Rusk County, we turn to you now. Hi, Bev.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about my 3.5-year-old male Abyssinian who was diagnosed with stomatitis in February, and our vet had removed the molars, hoping that that would help. And within about a month and a half, he had similar symptoms, wasn't eating. When he get up to the food bowl, he'd look at, like, wanting to eat, and then he would, like, scream or he'd run away from it, you know.
Oh, boy.
Anticipating the pain. And so I brought him back, like, the second time, and then the vet removed the premolars, and he really was reluctant to do this, being that he's so young. And the vet told us that there's very little research done on stomatitis, so there's, you know, not much of a protocol on how to treat it in a successful way. So now, in fact, we started him on laser treatment. So he, in fact, the first time he took the molars out, he gave him one laser treatment just to see how he would do. And then maybe he said he should get better, but he didn't. So now I just brought him back today for his fourth laser treatment.
Okay, yeah.
And he also recommended maybe we could try this lysine as they've maybe had some help with that. And otherwise, he's very healthy.
And now he's eating well now that those painful?
No, he's not. And this fourth treatment, in fact, I was even wondering if this is doing any well. So our vet recommended that he go back two more times. And the left side of his mouth is worse than the right side, especially in the back, and it was, like, really macerated.
Oh, my goodness.
And he says today he was able, and he's able to administer the laser without any anesthesia.
Yeah.
So today he was able to touch all the sides of his gums, and he tolerated. So he said it seems to be getting better, but now even like now the canines are showing redness
right.
on the gum line.
Yeah, yeah. This is a condition very common in Abyssinians, which your cat is, and it goes by the letters LPGS, and it's not Ladies Pro Golf, okay? It's It stands for lymphocytic plasmacytic gingivitis stomatitis.
Yeah.
Big name, but very common, very nasty problem that many cats seem to suffer from. What it is actually, we believe, an immune problem where their immune system can't deal with the normal plaque or bacteria that adhere to the teeth. With daily, you know, multiple times a day, extensive brushing and so on, sometimes you can keep this under control. But just even a little bit of plaque, that bacteria in the mouth on the teeth, can trigger this really severe red, bleeding, inflamed gums that are painful and make the cat have a difficult time eating. The treatment is typically full mouth extractions. And once all those teeth are out of there, we typically get a good response. I'm not familiar with using laser surgery to or laser treatments to be able to treat this. Usually we're looking at, you know, kind of staged full mouth extractions, and we'll see these cats with no teeth. Their gums are beautiful now, eating, you know, even crunchy cat food. They just down it whole. So sometimes they do have to be on a softer food to be, allow them to be able to eat. So talk to your veterinarian about that. That may be something to be thinking about. You may want to even consider a visit to an oral surgeon. We have several board-certified dentists, veterinary dentists in the state, and I know somebody in the Milwaukee area as well as at the vet school in Madison. And if your veterinarian isn't biopsying these spots, it's real important that some of this tissue also be biopsied, because there's other conditions that can occur in the mouth besides this. Lysine as a treatment, lysine is an amino acid that we have found it's been primarily used for treating cats with chronic herpes infection. And herpes is known as rhinotracheitis in cats. It's a viral infection that usually causes chronic upper respiratory, ocular changes, and so on. It can be associated with some chronic oral changes as well, but not usually. But you could try using the lysine. It's not going to hurt. It's available commercially. There is one brand that just spell lysine backwards, and that's what it is. It's Enacil, I think how it's pronounced. You can also just buy it at a health food store and use it in a tableted form as well and give it to a cat every day. It's not going to hurt. It may help, but don't want to stress your cat out and be pilling them if their mouth is sore. So it would be something you'd have to be able to get into their food.
Okay. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. Lots of callers online, so we'll go right back to the phones. And Paul in East Troy, your turn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Great show.
Thanks.
Our 12-year-old male cat is currently being treated with prednisone. Or prednisolone, I think is the actual title of the drug. His symptoms originally were that he could not hold anything down, water, food, or anything, was throwing up, violently back in February. Simultaneous with that, he also began to limp very appreciably, almost as if he had dysplasia in the rear hip. The treatment with prednisolone from our veterinarian, whom we love and respect and so on, seems to be doing the trick, although it does have some side effects. My question to you is basically, what possibilities might there be? Is there some sort of general inflammatory disease that can affect an animal like this? When we adopted him, he had a herpes virus, and I don't know if that would have anything to do with it either, but take your response.
Yeah, herpes probably doesn't have anything to do with this. A couple things. One, 12-year-old cats a very high percentage of cats do get arthritis. And because we don't tend to walk them like we do dogs, it's not as noticeable. What owners will say is, you know, yeah, they're just not jumping up as much, or they're having a little problem balancing in the litter box, and so they're going next to the litter box. Or there could be, you know, little symptoms like that. And so the arthritic change may have absolutely nothing to do with what was causing the vomiting. The reason why your veterinarian probably pulled out steroids is one of the common causes of chronic gastrointestinal problems in cats that can cause diarrhea, vomiting, and so on. It can affect anywhere in the GI tract, is a problem called inflammatory bowel disease, kind of like Crohn's disease in people. And it tends to be very steroid responsive. You know, typically the diagnosis of that is made by a biopsy, either going endoscopically with an endoscope down into the stomach and getting biopsies, or doing an exploratory laparotomy and taking biopsies that way, and as well as looking at lymph nodes to make sure that we don't have something like cancer affecting the intestinal tract. There is a form of cancer that can affect the intestinal tract called lymphoma or lymphosarcoma that, again, tends to be at least temporarily steroid responsive. And so sometimes we can buy the cat some time by using steroids as well. So, you know, I'm not sure how much diagnostic work was done or whether it was just discussed, so, well, let's just try this response to therapy. But that may be your next step, is trying to figure out, you know, can we wean him off of this? Is there something we can do besides steroids, like a hypoallergenic diet, which may help some of these kitties with inflammatory bowel disease? You know, and if his, you know, he's continuing to have symptoms, then, you know, I think you're really forced to start looking into getting some other diagnostics done.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And on to Britt in Appleton. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about, I have a 15-month-old Irish setter. Several months ago, she was diagnosed with Helicobacter and IBD, as mm-hmm. you were just talking about, after having surgery and having a biopsy and ruling out lots of other things. So what we ended up doing to help her digestion is to put her on a raw, commercially prepared raw diet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've done a lot of research and a lot of reading and probably too much reading, and I guess I just want your opinion on your the bacteria in some of those foods and how that could affect her. She is very sensitive. You know, she can't eat the red meat. I can usually do chicken and poultry,
yeah,
and some salmon and that kind of thing. But any red meat causes her to vomit. She's very thin from recovering from this. And yeah. I guess I'm just looking for your opinion on the bacteria in that food.
Yeah, and it may be that she has a dietary hypersensitivity. I don't know if you've ever gone through a diet trial to see, by using like a hydrolyzed protein diet as a food trial, just to see if she does have food allergies to certain things. Because definitely beef is one of the top three in dogs for causing okay. food allergies. So if she can't handle red meat, that may be one of the things that you might want to be looking into.
Okay.
What I'm really concerned about always with raw diets is a number of things. One, whether they're balanced or not. And most of the diets, even recipes that are published, when they're actually looked at, they're found to not be a well-balanced diet. There have been virtually no studies done, long-term feeding studies with these diets, to show their long-term health effects on lots and lots of different dogs. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of consumer beware when you start doing this. So, you know, be careful with that. The big thing that we're always concerned about is pathogens that are contained in the food. Just like we wouldn't eat raw chicken because we're concerned about salmonella and E. coli and so on, it's the same problem with dogs. They may not develop clinical signs of it, but there was one study done where they've actually, for assistance dogs, they have put out a warning that no raw diets be used, because many people that are using assistance dogs have health issues that would require them to, you know, not be around a dog that may be carrying pathogens that would be a problem for them. But what they found is 61% of dogs that consumed a raw meat diet were found to shed salmonella during the year, compared to only when you looked at 8% of dogs that are just kind of your normal, you know, dogs that are not, you know, eating commercial diet, but maybe stealing the raw, you know, the hamburger off the counter, or eating a dead mouse, or, you know, doing something like that. And so these, you know, it's you know, very high, much higher increase in the pathogen shedding, which can be a risk to you. So licking your face, having their nose touch you, because they can even culture salmonella from like the nostril area where it's contact with the dishes. And even the dishes, after they have been cleaned in a dishwasher with high heat, well, you can still culture some of the more pathogenic E. coli. So make sure you're using dedicated dishes that do not get mixed with your dishes, and do not even get run through the dishwasher with your dishes.
Really?
Yeah. So it's definitely something that if you're doing it, you're finding good results. You know, be very watchful for your, you know, any symptoms that you may have, and be careful with your family, especially if there's anybody that is immunocompromised. Young children, elderly people, people on immunosuppressive drugs, AIDS patients, that kind of thing, have to be extremely cautious.
All right. Okay. Wonderful. Thank you for that information.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. Aaron in Oshkosh emailed and said, my vet prescribed Deramax for our lab mix, age 10, for arthritis in the knee, but it's very expensive for us to afford. I've asked the vet several times for an effective alternative, since there is no generic for this, but they insist there is nothing else. Anything you could recommend to try and help the dog out?
I get asked this question a lot, because there are many non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, because we've got this aging dog population. We see lots of arthritic changes and so on. And we're also, as veterinarians, more, as years have gone by, more conscious about dealing with pain and post-operative pain management. And so thus the development of all these different drugs. And Deramax or Daracoxib is an excellent anti-inflammatory drug. The writer is right that it's not available in a generic form yet. If your dog is tolerating that one, there is one that has been on the market a little bit longer that if your dog, and again, every dog's different, whether they tolerate it or not, but it's the generic version of Rimadyl or carprofen. And if you just, you know, Google, you know, generic carprofen, it'll come up, and it's called Novox. It's probably about half the price of Rimadyl. The downside is that it's a drug that usually needs to be used twice a day, whereas with Deramax, it's a once-a-day drug. And some dogs have better GI tolerance of one over the other. So, you know, use it as a trial. Usually what we recommend is when we're switching from one non-steroidal to another, that we do a washout period of several days, usually 5 to 7 days, getting them off the drug, and then start the new one. And, you know, just sit back and watch and wait for clinical signs. Make sure you're always giving this drug with a meal, because it can be irritating to the stomach. One thing that I'm going to tell you not to go to is some of the human drugs that are out there. Even though carprofen sounds like ibuprofen, the therapeutic dose of ibuprofen for a dog is so close to the toxic dose that we just can't use it safely. And it's just the reverse for humans. We can't handle carprofen, but we can handle ibuprofen. So don't be reaching for your Advil or your generic ibuprofen. Same is true with aspirin. Very high risk of gastric ulcers and so on if you're using it at therapeutic levels. So avoid using that unless there's a reason for it. And sometimes at very low doses, we'll use those for treating some problems that we may have some problems with platelet adhesion, and we may use it under veterinary supervision at much lower doses, not anti-inflammatory doses.
All right, let's go to Carol next in Madison. Carol, thanks for waiting. Hello. Carol, are you there? Yeah, maybe we lost Carol.
Okay.
All right,
well,
let's go to Jeanette in La Crosse. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I was wondering if you could help me. I have a 12-year-old Yorkie. She's 8 pounds, and she's real active. We had her up in northern Wisconsin walking out in a rocky area, and she was real excited. There must have been a little animal or something nearby, and she was sniffing real vigorously. And all of a sudden, it's like she snorted up something and started sneezing real violently, mm-hmm. like she was trying to expel something. And we took her to the vet because she periodically all of a sudden starts to have this violent, you know, like she's trying to expel this from her nose again.
Mm-hmm.
And the vet put her on an antibiotic because he said it looked red up there, and then was going to eventually look to see if there might be something up there. Do you have any clue?
Yeah. I mean, we do see dogs inhaling foreign bodies, getting them up their nose. In fact, my Yorkie, I used to have a Yorkie named Electra. She had a grass blade up her nose. So she had inhaled grass blade and had a unilateral, meaning one-sided nasal discharge and recurrent sneezing. And that prompted me to get her in for a look-see. The first thing we did for the nasal extravaganza was she was anesthetized, and I did a CT scan, a CAT scan of her skull to see if there was any bony changes. Because, you know, a 12-year-old dog that's doing this kind of thing, things like nasal tumors and things would still be on our list, or, you know, tooth root abscesses, which can, you know, erode into the nasal passages. So having that looked into first, and then having a look up there with a scope, and trying to find a little tiny fiber optic scope that can go up a Yorkie nose can be a little difficult. So you may be looking at a visit to a specialist to have this done. Sometimes we find if you want to just try something without going through a lot of diagnostic stuff is do what we call therapeutic nasal flushing. It still requires anesthesia. She would be under anesthesia, intubated with a tube down her trachea so that she can continue to breathe. Her back of her throat is packed with a lot of gauze, and we just take water and flush it up through her nostrils and try to get anything out through kind of the backside. Kind of like us doing, have you ever used a neti pot for, you know, nasal, you know, nasal irritation? Although this is kind of like a power wash version of that. and dogs don't tolerate it in an awake state, so they have to be asleep. And sometimes if it's a little, you know, piece of grass, foreign body, we may be able to give the dog some relief and get it out. But, you know, I think I'll leave that up to you and your veterinarian as to whether, you know, you need to jump in and start looking at doing the full nasal workup or trying something like that.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Joe emailed us and has a 3-year-old mixed breed lab who's been having brief seizures that occur about once a month. They last about 5 minutes and are fairly minor as seizures go. Our vet suggested eliminating wheat and soy from his diet. That hasn't had any effect. Any other ideas?
Yeah, I rarely ever see food allergies or intolerances causing seizures. We do know that labs are one of the breeds that we do see epilepsy in. Questions that I would want to have for this person would be, when did the seizures start? To give you an example, I had a 12-week-old puppy in yesterday that was a little Scotty puppy that just started having some seizures. And so when we think of young dogs having seizures, that we start thinking more about birth defects, either of the brain or problems with the liver, a shunt that could cause some problems with the brain secondarily. Mm. Old dogs, and I'm not talking 3, I'm talking like teenagers, like past 10, brain tumors are on our list of rule outs. But middle-aged dog, like that starts seizuring around 2 with normal lab work, no neurologic deficits, no history of trauma, it most likely is epilepsy. And I use the little rule of thumb that if a dog's having more than 6 to 12 seizures per year, if they are coming in clusters, meaning 1 or 2 or 3 in a row over like a day, then and they start lasting longer than 5 to 10 minutes, or the dog has a prolonged what we call post-ictal effect, meaning after the seizure they're really demented and not their normal self, then treatment is probably warranted. And treatment usually means starting with a drug called phenobarbital. Dogs tolerate it very well. It does require some monitoring, not only drug levels, but liver values as well. But many dogs do quite well on that as just a single anticonvulsant drug. So I think it's time, if you're once a month doing this, time to go back to the veterinarian.
All right. On to Diane in Milton. Diane, hi.
Hi. I have a 14-year-old mixed breed pet, and she was diagnosed with cataracts and then with, I can't remember the name of it. But anyway, the vet prescribed pilocarpine ophthalmic solution and
pilocarpine, okay.
And dorzolamide and dextromethocyne.
Okay. Well, I think your dog is being treated with numerous topical drugs. And I assume this is a dog, right?
Yes.
Yes, okay. 14-year-old dog with cataracts. You know, if it's, you know, the various drugs that you're using may help cause the pupils to dilate to allow the dog to be able to see a little bit better. The dexamethasone drops may make the inflammatory changes that may be occurring in the eye be a little bit less so that the eye is more comfortable. But if your dog is having, you know, that much problems with cataracts, you may want to be looking at if she's a good surgical candidate, having them surgically removed.
She also has the one that causes blindness.
There's a condition that dogs will get. Before we ever think about removing cataracts, we always want to make sure that the rest of the eye is functioning normally.
Uh-huh.
And a number of dogs, especially poodles and poodle mixes, will have what's called progressive retinal atrophy, which is a gradual degeneration of the retina.
Okay. When I use this medicine, it made it worse.
Okay.
So I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Are you working with a veterinary ophthalmologist?
No.
Okay, that would be your next step.
And where would I find that?
Well, you can contact your veterinarian and just let them know, you know, I'd like a referral to an ophthalmologist.
Mm-hmm.
Right here in Madison, we have, at the vet school, as well as a private referral ophthalmologist that works here at one of our local big referral centers. So we've got a couple here. I know there's ophthalmology teams up in the Green Bay area. Over in Milwaukee, there's an ophthalmologist as well. You may, depending on where you live, have to travel a little bit. But I think that if you bring all your medical records, bottles of drugs that you've been using, then they'd be able to perhaps come up with a treatment plan that's going to keep your dog healthy and happy and comfortable during your senior years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
You're
all
welcome.
Right, thanks a lot for calling. Amy emailed us and has a 2-year-old Norwegian forest cat who recently developed a lump on his neck. An aspiration of the lump revealed eosinophils, indicating a possible
eosinophilic granuloma. There
you go. That's right.
Okay. And I'm not reading this. I'm just guessing from what Larry's saying.
Yeah, I'm trying to read this, the spelling on this, which can sometimes be associated with allergies. Anyway, the lump shrank dramatically after steroids were given. Have you heard of this symptom relating to allergies in a cat?
Yes. Yes, I have. And what's really interesting is that we never really thought that much about allergies, cats having allergies versus us having allergies to cats. But cats can be allergic, just like dogs, to all kinds of things in the environment, from house dust mites, pollens, all kinds of things. And it can present many, many different ways. And I just had a kitty in, it was an Egyptian Mau, in the last few months that had very similar type thing, a big, raw, raised area on the back of the neck that it was constantly traumatizing. Turned out that the cat needs to be on a hypoallergenic diet for the rest of its life. And it's also on a drug called cyclosporine, which is a immune modulating drug that helps alleviate some of the allergic signs that the cat may be having, and is doing phenomenally well. The area went away, hair is growing back, and the cat's a happy cat. So, these are cases that do require a lot of hands-on treatment, playing with drug dosages, playing with diets. I worry a little bit when you say it's in the neck area. Hopefully the cat did not receive an injection or a vaccine in that area, because sometimes that can be a trigger of things like this as well. So, you know, go back and check in the history to see if it's at all linked with a vaccine or something like that. So hopefully all the vaccines are being given in the leg where they're supposed to be given. That's the national mm-hmm. guidelines for cats now.
She also asked, I should have brought this up right away, is there a Claritin-type drug?
An antihistamine, yeah.
That can be used to keep these allergies.
We do sometimes put cats on antihistamines, although they rarely are sole treatment effective.
No.
But we do use antihistamines once in a while. I have not seen a lot of success with that.
All right. Let's go to Cheryl in Superior. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I am wondering, I got a new kitty and indoors only. Why would I need to have rabies shots for her?
What a good question. Well, I just brought this up at the beginning of the show, and you're doing it for two reasons. One is your liability. Rabies is a fatal disease for people, and as a result, if your cat were to bite somebody, we have to assume the worst, that your cat may be rabid, even though you don't have any history of exposure or anything, which means that your cat would have to go through rabies quarantine. Depending on where you live, it may be 10 days in confinement at a vet clinic. It may be a separate rabies confinement area, but your cat would be taken away from you and looked at as being high risk if it had not been vaccinated. The other reason is that strange things happen, and I'll give you an example. I had a family with an unvaccinated, well, actually she was 12 years overdue for her rabies vaccine, seen a veterinarian for 12 years. They found a bat on the floor, and their mother-in-law was visiting. They had two kids, husband and wife, two kids, and their mother-in-law. Cat was found playing with this dead bat. They took the bat to the lab of hygiene, which you always should do. If you ever find a bat in your house, it doesn't cost anything. You can take it directly to the state lab of hygiene here in Madison or have your veterinarian ship it there. And it was positive for rabies. The whole family had to go through rabies post-exposure prophylaxis. And their cat was quarantined for 6 months. So it was a much longer quarantine for the cat and a mess for the family as well. So, you know, this would be something that, who knows if it could happen, but that's why we have to vaccinate even indoor cats.
Even indoor cats. And the State Lab of Hygiene does a great job. My mother worked there for many years and did those tests.
And they actually have, and I just pulled this out and I didn't really read that much about it, but there's a brand new rabies rapid screen test that it looks at, they're able to look at saliva and look for rabies antigen in saliva. You can get results within 35 minutes and it may eliminate some of the quarantine period that's required. I don't know any states that have adopted the use of this test yet, but it's something that's new that's out there that maybe in the future something that will help some of our beloved pets then keep them out of quarantine if we can show that they are not carrying rabies at the time that the bite occurred.
All right. We have Danielle from Madison who just moved into a new house last night and their one-year-old cat's been acting very scared and shy. This can be part of an adjustment, anything to do to ease the transition.
Well, usually I recommend trying to confine the cat to one room with things that smell like the old house. So leave your, you know, bedspread that you haven't washed, that the cat slept on, and just kind of give the cat an efficiency apartment so they can get used to the place room by room. The other thing I'd recommend is run into the pet store or to your veterinarian and buying some feel-away. It's also known as comfort zone for cats, but buying feel-away is one of the brand names, and it's a facial pheromone in an atomizer that you can plug in, make the whole house smell comfortable and relaxed for the cat. It's when cats are comfortable and relaxed, they'll go up and rub their cheeks against things and mark them. They're leaving their scent behind, and that is something that we've been able to come up with, a synthetic version of this, put it in an atomizer so the whole house will smell like a comfortable, relaxed environment for your cat. Aromatherapy with science, this is the way I like to call it.
And so, we don't smell it.
We don't smell it. No, it doesn't do anything for us or for the family dog. So, just cats.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here with Jim Packard on the phones on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Jean in Oak Creek next. Hello, Jean.
Hello.
Thank you for
taking my call. Yeah.
Sure.
I have a 6-year-old English bulldog. She was diagnosed with dry eyes, and every morning she has this real gooey green drainage that I have to wipe away from her eyes or she can't see a thing, and she's been prescribed a steroid ointment I put in 2 or 3 times daily and a cyclosporine-type eye drop.
Mm-hmm. This is a...
And if I don't use it, her eyes just return to the bad
sticky things.
Yeah, this is a, well, as you know, I have two English bulldogs at home, Bulldozer and Vanna White Trash. So, yes, so, yeah. And I just had one in yesterday named Theodore Bone or T-Bone, and I thought, what a great name for a bulldog. But what's yours name? What is your dog's name?
Phoebe.
Oh, that's good for a nice little girl. But, you know, dry eye, or what's called KCS, keratoconjunctivitis cica, is very, very, very common in bulldogs. And, in fact, so common that when I see my dogs with a little bit of goo in their eye, that's the first thing I do is check their tear production, because it can happen relatively quickly, and it's so common in the breed. Why? I have no idea, but it just seems to be something that we see more often. The tear glands, just for whatever reason, stop making tears. And so you can imagine, if you didn't have normal tear production, what your eyes would feel like, kind of sandpapery. You don't have that normal kind of washing system over the front of the eye. And so you'll get secondary infections. It's extremely painful, can result in corneal damage. And so these are, when we have a dog with dry, that's been diagnosed with dry eye, it's lifetime therapy. And besides using topical antibiotics to keep the infection under control, topical cyclosporine to try to keep that's actually a drug. I mentioned it also earlier for treating cats with allergies and dogs with allergies. Because it's a drug that works on the immune system, we feel that many dogs that have dry eye have it because they have an immune problem where their immune system is fighting off their own tear-producing glands. And sometimes we can reverse that to some degree by keeping them on this particular drug, but they're usually on it for life. The other thing we'll do is make sure that the owner has lots of different types of artificial tears available. And one of my favorite ones is called Genteel Gel. You can buy it over the counter at any human drugstore. It doesn't have a lot of preservatives or anything in it, so it tends to be quite safe to use long term. And they do have one that's like for extreme dry eye. That's perfect for putting in the dog's eye before you go to bed. So you should have artificial tears on every coffee table, bedside table, near every door. So you're constantly putting them in the dog's eyes and then following your veterinarian's instructions regarding treating infections and using cyclosporine.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Good luck
for calling. And we'll turn to Mary and Racine. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When I got in my car, you were talking about beef being an allergy for dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Our daughter lives in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she has a golden retriever, which I think probably are a little more prone to allergies than possibly some of the other dogs.
Oh, yes. They're the poster child for allergies.
Yeah. He's itching all the time. And, you know, we suggested that she get him on a lamb diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly what he's on right now, because we've had problems with dogs in the past with allergies too, and we found that if we got him onto a dog food with lamb, they seem to do a little better. But I didn't know about the beef being a problem.
Well, unfortunately, lamb can be just as allergenic as beef.
Okay.
The only reason why lamb became kind of a staple for many people to grab when they had a dog that had food allergies. And the only way to diagnose a dog with food allergies, even though there is a blood test out there, it's extremely unreliable. The only way to diagnose it is an elimination diet trial. So we're looking at about 8 weeks to 12 weeks of a therapeutic diet that's usually a hydrolyzed protein diet. They get that and nothing else, that and water. They don't get a dog biscuit. They don't even get their flavored heartworm preventative. We have to switch to a different non-flavored heartworm preventative. And then if you want to really find out if the dog is, you know, what they're allergic to, you start adding something in, like you have a chicken day, you have a tofu day, you know, or a week, beef week, and you start adding that in to see, do they react to it? By far more golden retrievers, rather than having food allergies, are probably allergic to environmental allergens, pollens, molds, you know, house dust mites, those types of things. And that's what I would be looking at. And I think you could go down, you know, both paths simultaneously if you wanted to. Make sure that if the dog is itchy, that if there's any secondary infections, yeast infections, bacterial infections, that those are being treated as well. But, you know, back to the lamb issue, the only reason why that got picked is back, you know, 30 years ago when we started recognizing dogs having food allergies, we wanted to find a protein source that most American dogs had never had. Thus, lamb, because very few Americans eat lamb on a regular basis, so it's not, you know, a staple in our kitchen.
Right.
So lamb became the food that we would go to, but now that it's in everything from treats and pet foods, we're seeing lamb allergies just as much as we are to anything else. And
okay.
So we've even had to resort to importing kangaroo, and so we have a kangaroo and oat diet that we use for dogs now that are food allergic, you know, and we have to come up with some very bizarre protein sources to try to meet
sure.
the dog's needs. But yeah, I think that, you know, getting this dog in for an allergy workup, looking at environmental allergens is probably going to be more important.
All
well,
right.
yeah, we've tried to talk her to get it, take him into the veterinary school in Minneapolis. They have one there, and
mm-hmm.
they do have an allergy department. So if she could get him in there, I think they probably could have her out, help her out a little bit more.
Right. There's lots of things that can be done from, you know, treating the secondary infections to, you know, getting them going on drugs like, I keep bringing up this cyclosporine. I should have stock in that company, but we do use that for treating allergies in dogs, to allergy testing and getting them on injections to desensitize them to what they're allergic to. So there's a whole range of things that you can do to make the dog comfortable.
Is cyclosporine topical or do
it's
they
an oral? It's an oral medication.
An oral.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
very good. Okay, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Mary in Appleton emailed us and says, I'm interested in your opinion of homeopathic remedies for dogs. I heard about this homeopathic procedure where the dog's skin is scanned and a computer program will take this info and give a remedy for skin conditions. Sounds like a scam to me, Mary says. What do you think?
Ooh, I don't want to, you know, say nasty things about something I don't know anything about. But again, I think you have to be, you know, really careful when something sounds too good to be true. And I have never heard of a scan for skin conditions like this. I'd be looking at, have they done studies? Are they, you know, good studies where they've done, like, you know, blinded studies and so on and had more than one person interpret the results? That's the kind of information you need, not just, well, I had it done to my dog and they did well, so now let's market this. So, you know, there is a place. Homeopathy is one of those alternative types of medicine that has a place, and many people get good results with it, and I don't want to knock it at all, but this sounds a little out there. So do your homework before you start spending money on it.
All right, let's go to Lynn in Evansville now. Lynn, hello to you.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I know
sure.
we're kind of short on time, so I'll try to be speedy. I have a cat that was given to me as a foundling. She looked to be a inbred farm kitty. She's about five now, but she's had, from the get-go, eye problems insofar as she has exudate that dries around her eyes and stains her nose. And I had taken her to a vet a while ago, and she was diagnosed with entropion, and so she had surgery, which was marginally successful for a time, but then the situation reoccurred with inflammation of her eyes and the staining. So I had taken her to a second vet who suggested that, again, it might be an allergy. She was placed on a low-allergen hydrolyzed protein diet from Science Diet for a time, and unfortunately, it persists, and so now I've got, again, prednisone.
Yeah,
prednisone drops, but it seems to be treating the symptoms rather than the underlying problem, and even with once a day, it needs to be three times a day, and so I haven't really found out what the issue is, and wondered when you were talking for dogs about dry eye therapy, if this might be a contributory cause. Do cats get it?
Cats can have dry eye. They tend to, it's a little more difficult to interpret what we call a Schirmer tear test, which is the test that we use to measure tear production. But it's something that we do, you know, see, definitely not as common as we do in dogs. By far, the most common cause of chronic ocular discharge in cats is a chronic herpes infection. And if she came from a barn situation, and it can be waxing and waning, meaning that she has good weeks and bad weeks, just like, you know, herpes that, you know, with cold sores and so on that we get.
Mm-hmm.
This is one thing where if you have not tried chronic lysine use, I mentioned it earlier in the show, lysine is an amino acid. You can get it in proprietary preparations from your veterinarian that are flavored for cat use in a gel or a powder that you mix with food. You can also buy the tablets at human health food stores and have them on it. So talk to your veterinarian about trying something like that as well. But, you know, that would be what I'd be looking at. And if you've not been to a veterinary ophthalmologist, again, I sound like a broken record, but sometimes when we have these really chronic problems, and you know, I admit, and I'm so lucky that I work in a place where all I have to do is open an exam room door and go, hey, I got a problem here. This cat isn't getting better. You know, can I bring in a specialist? And they happen to be right there. But, you know, maybe talk to your veterinarian and say, you know, is it all right if I get a second opinion? Take your medical records, all the drugs that you've been using on your kitty, and that's, you know, they may be able to help you. But I'd at least at this point, maybe check the tear production as well as, you know, trying some lysine before you start jumping into visiting a specialist.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Amy emailed us and says, my cat's been diagnosed with hypercalcemia. We have done numerous tests to rule out cancer and hyperthyroidism. My vet suggested to take her to a specialist, which is expensive. Is there anything I can do? Would a change in diet help? What's the prognosis?
Yeah, hypercalcemia, having a problem with your calcium phosphorus balance. When the calcium levels get too high, all your soft tissues, like your kidneys and so on, will start to calcify, and it can be a fatal disease. And we can see this for a number of reasons. One may be there's a gland in the body called the parathyroid gland, and sometimes we'll see parathyroid tumors that can be very tiny and not easily felt. And it, you can do a blood test to actually look at parathyroid levels to see if that's what is going on, to think, you know, that would push you down that way.
Sure.
To have that done. Alternatively, looking for what's called pseudo-hyperparathyroidism, which is usually due to cancer, and it sounds like they've already done that. So I'd be looking at blood test for hyperparathyroidism.
All right. And tell you what, we've got lots of callers online, but you can join in, too, with your questions as we visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If your pet is having a health problem, this might be a good time to phone in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, as we talk your pet's health. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Glenn in Stevens Point. Glenn, hello. Thank you for waiting.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention, we've got a 4-year-old male cat. Had him for about a year and a half now, almost 2 years. Lived in one house. He was fine. He lived with a younger 2-year-old female cat. Everything was fine. And then when he moved to the new house or a little bit later, he just started to methodically pull his hair out of his legs and all over his stomach, like from a halfway down.
Mm-hmm.
And not very nervous, not very anxious, pretty calm cat. Walks around. There's a dog in the house, too, but they've met before. They get along pretty well.
Okay.
But it's very methodical. Like, you'll turn around and you'll look, and he'll look up, and he'll have a mouth full of hair.
Yeah.
Just casually spit it out and then go back to work. It seems like, I don't know. It seems
no, he has no skin changes at all except for the fact that he's just plucked like a chicken.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and it said it's only on the certain areas, but then he started on his back a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's starting to come back, but it doesn't seem like he has any of the tendencies of, you know, like any hypertension or anything that would...
Yeah, I mean, we used to think that when cats would do this, they would just kind of barber their, you know, inside of their legs and their stomach, that it was all stress related. And we called it psychogenic alopecia, meaning just it was all in their head. And it was kind of like a person biting their fingernails or doing something. It was their way of coping with stressful situations. And stress could be, you know, it's all relative. And it could be that, you know, there's a neighbor dog next door, or the house is, you know, he feels like he's like in a fishbowl if people can look in or something. But, you know, just back to this thing, you know, is it truly a psychological problem? We are now finding that most of these cats have some underlying medical reason why they're itchy and or pulling their hair out. And even though their skin is normal, they usually have something else going on, whether it be a parasite infestation with there's a mite called Demodex that cats can get that can cause them to pull their hair out like this, and we look for that. We've seen some cats with ringworm, which is a fungus, look like this as well, so we'll do some fungal cultures. Sometimes bacterial or yeast infections may look like this as well. And so sometimes we look for that or go through a trial of therapy to see if we can clear that up. And then we start looking at, does this cat have allergies to something, whether it be a flea allergy, dermatitis, or allergies to food, and it's not the food, but ingredients in the food, or environmental allergens. So you can see this is not one of these here, just do this and we'll get an answer. You do have to go about it, you know, methodically to try to get the answer. And sometimes we'll, you know, get them on heavy duty flea treatment. We'll put them on a hypoallergenic diet simultaneously, and we'll do all these other tests while we're waiting for those tests to come back. We'll see how the cat does and, you know, go down that route. Sometimes we jump into doing some allergy testing too. So, it's, you know, I think up to you and your veterinarian how you feel your cat's, you know, comfort level is. But if he's pulling his hair out, there's something wrong. And I think it really deserves some type of workup.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Lynn in Wausau, on to you now. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Thank you. We have a 13-year-old yellow lab. And last year she was diagnosed with Lyme. So she was put on treatment for that. And then we actually kept her on a couple extra weeks, mainly because I had a lot of friends that said, you know, we did it for the time they said, and then it seemed like it came back. Now, intermittently, she seems like she has kind of pain or a limp once in a while, but since she was positive for Lyme's, you can't really test again for it, can you? Because then she's going to have that.
Yeah. This is a real dilemma because a lot of dogs in our state test positive and yet don't have the disease. Testing positive, it does not equal Lyme disease. It means they've been exposed. And only a small percentage of dogs will actually develop clinical signs of Lyme disease. And those clinical signs can be, you know, fever, lameness, you know, pain, that kind of thing, to severe kidney involvement as well. One of the things that your veterinarian can do is there is a test, and there's a little controversy about, you know, how reliable this test is, but it's called a quantitative C6 Lyme antibody test. Okay. So if you ask for a quantitative C6 Lyme test, your veterinarian will know what you're talking about. It's that you'll actually get a number. And this is not a test that's affected by vaccine, which many dogs are vaccinated with for Lyme, with Lyme vaccine. It's only a test that shows up positive from exposure, and it gives you an actual number, and it's a number that you can track. And so you can say, okay, prior to treatment, here's what my C6 level was in my dog. After treatment, and it can take about 6 months to drop, we usually will see a 50% or greater drop if it, treatment has been effective and you know, we've got it under control. So that would be something that, if you know, in the future then, if your dog is re-exposed, because past exposure doesn't give you long-term immunity, you can be watching this number and have this number checked periodically to see if it's going up or down, and perhaps treat when we start seeing it getting up in the higher ranges.
Okay, and what they had done also, because she seemed, you know, things were really hurting, they had given me tramadol, which is whole thing.
Yeah, tramadol is a pain medication that's relatively new in the veterinary world that we're using. We use this when we have a dog that is not tolerant of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like Rimadyl or Deramax, or there's a number of them out there on the market. And so if you've tried those and your dog gets upset tummy or diarrhea, or maybe has some underlying liver or kidney issues that doesn't allow it to be on that, then we can use this. This is not an anti-inflammatory, so it doesn't relieve pain by relieving inflammation. It works in the brain, and it relieves the sensation of pain. And so for some dogs, we'll use combinations of both those things, especially as dogs get older. It means we can use less of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. We can add this in. Can make them a little bit spacey, but most dogs tolerate it real well. You know, they don't have to drive cars or hold a job, so, you know, they can sleep on the couch and be pain-free. But I probably would not have grabbed that as my first drug. I would have used a non-steroidal.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Lynn. We'll turn to Jody in Madison next. Jody, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I really enjoyed listening to you, Sandy. Thank you so much for doing this. And because I listened so carefully, I just heard one thing that you kind of forgot to mention, and I know it didn't really go with the case, but it just had to do with hypercalcemia.
Yeah.
The other reason for hypercalcemia is renal.
Oh, yes. Thank you. It was right at noon, and, you know, I had, like,
I
Larry's
know,
going,
hungry.
No, he's doing the countdown. Like, okay, we got 5 seconds. And, yeah, we do see a number of, there's a whole host of reasons why animals can, and that's why we monitor calcium levels. But, you know, renal issues can cause hypercalcemia, certain types of cancer, there's a whole host of things. I would have to assume that if this cat was being managed for hypercalcemia, that besides checking calcium level, they probably did a full chemistry panel and a urinalysis and ruled out kidney disease. And that was just me making that assumption on the fly after that. So, but thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, these are complicated cases, and it's usually looking at doing, you know, a lot of, you know, x-rays, abdominal ultrasound to rule out cancer, and other blood tests you send outside labs to try to find some answers.
Thanks, Jody.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Diane emailed us and has a 2-year-old, excuse me, Shetland sheepdog with bad breath and red gums. The vet put him on a pulse program where he's on antibiotics 14 days, then 1 week for the next 3 months. Have you heard of this program? Does it work? I brush his teeth three times a week, plus an oral rinse, but his gums still look red. He had his teeth cleaned last October. They look good, doesn't chew on anything, and refuses to eat anything that's hard.
Oh, so see, she's got a dog that doesn't like to do its own brushing by chewing on the appropriate things. So what can we do? Pulse therapy antibiotics is controversial in the dentistry world. Usually we use it for like a week, once a month. We'll put them on an antibiotic. Where I've done this is a dog that has severe periodontal disease, is not a good anesthetic candidate because it's got, you know, significant heart disease or organ malfunction, and we're trying to keep the mouth as comfortable as we can. So it's the risk is that by just, you know, not getting rid of the disease and giving the dog antibiotics, that you may be selecting for resistant bacteria. And so it's not ideal, but if it's the only thing that we can do to provide the dog some comfort, then we do this. The fact that this dog is only 2, a few things that I would do. Number one, brush every day. This dog needs to have its teeth brushed every day. And so 2 or 3 times a week isn't cutting it. Make sure that you're using an appropriate toothpaste. There's some that are out there that are just kind of flavored things that have a little kind of pumice in them. Probably want to use a medicated toothpaste with chlorhexidine, maybe an anti-plaque agent incorporated in it as well. See what you can do with that. Rinses don't work that well. I mean, when we use a rinse, what does the dentist tell us to do but swish for a minute or two? When was the last time you saw a dog swishing stuff in their mouth? They usually, you're putting it in and it's coming right out. So they tend to be very low on the effectiveness rate. In fact, there's one rinse that's out there right now that a veterinary, you know, well-known manufacturer is making, that the active ingredient in it is xylitol. And xylitol, if you've heard me on previous shows, is a sweetener, and it's also a anti-plaque agent. That's the other thing that it does, that's used in a lot of gums and things for people. Highly toxic for dogs. Can cause them to have a profound insulin release and become hypoglycemic and die. And although this product, if it's diluted appropriately, is very safe, I always worry that is it going to be diluted appropriately. So I don't like my pet owners to use that product. I just tend to, you know, say don't use that one. But there are other chlorhexidine rinses and things that you could use, but you may have to be using those more frequently. You know, when it comes to finding out something that your dog likes, that they can chew on, that can be really difficult. And if he, you know, and it may be that he's not chewing on things because his gums hurt. So next time you go in for dentistry, which for dogs with significant gingivitis and periodontal disease should be every 6 months, talk to your veterinarian about a treatment of what's called Oravet. It's a product that is applied to the surface of the tooth, almost like a sealant that will keep the soft plaque from adhering and prevent the calculus from building up there. And that sometimes will help these dogs that are plaque intolerant. So think about having that done as well.
All right. And we have another email. Recently taken a kitten about 3 months old. He knows when he's doing something wrong and does it anyway. Jumping on counters, chewing on my phone, biting me, etc. I've been told getting him fixed will chill him out. Is that true? And what can I do to make him behave in the meantime?
Well, he's only 3 months old, and he is a kitten. And it's no different than having a toddler that can get into everything as well. And maybe after 50, 80, 100 times of you redirecting the cat to an appropriate thing, it may suddenly go like, oh, yeah, chew on my toy. Don't bite people. It's just a common, you know, these are all normal kitten type behaviors that neutering is not going to help. Neutering will stop your cat from having male type behaviors such as, wanting to go out and roam and fight with other boy cats. It may stop. Well, obviously, it's going to prevent him from being able to become a dad and stop his sex drive that way. And it may help decrease the incidence of urine marking, but it is not going to decrease activity level. The reason why people associate it with decreased activity level is it's usually done as kittens are maturing. And as they mature, they start to become a little more mellow. It's not the neutering that does that. It's just tincture of time. And some cats that are neutered, if you allow them to eat too much, they get overweight and then they become a little lazier. And that's not a good situation either. So, I think, thinking about reading a good book on cat behavior so that you can understand what's normal and what isn't. Be looking at lots of ways that you can entertain your cat safely with toys on strings and wands and so on. They really do need to have lots of dedicated playtime. We tend to not do that with cats. We get them so we can just, go about our business and they can do their own and then they get in trouble.
Our cat Tiger loves Jax, and we get these rubber ones, and he will chase. I'll throw that across the room. He'll race after it, get it, bring it back, drop it right at my feet.
Yep.
We go back and forth and back and forth, and he loves it.
Oh, and this business about getting on the kitchen counters, sometimes providing the cats with window seats and cat trees that they can climb up on. They like to be up high on things. And if they don't have something like that, they're going to get in trouble. They're going to be on the tables and up on the counters. Make sure all the food is put away that's out there that may be attracting your cat up there. There is a product that I really like called Scat. It's a compressed air in a can with a motion sensor on it. You can set on your kitchen counter. When the cat breaks the beam, it sprays air at it, makes a hissing sound. You don't have to be there. And so the counter is the thing that bites back. And that's the best way to train these cats.
Beverly in Westby, it's your turn. Hi, Beverly.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've been hoping for a chance to share this story about dogs that have seizures. I was working with a family about 10 years ago that had a nice terrier named Barnaby. And I guess Barnaby was maybe 10 years old, maybe a little older, and he started to have seizures, and which, was rather terrifying. Then for a long time, he wouldn't have a seizure, but like 6 weeks later, he'd have another seizure. And what it came to be aligned with was every time the exterminator came, after he left, Barnaby would have a seizure.
Wow. Yeah, toxins are one of those things that we can see causing neurologic problems in dogs. And, we sometimes forget that they're not washing their hands. They are down on floor level. And so anything that we may spray or use, including cleaning products, can be a problem for our pets. So we have to be careful with what we use in our house and make sure that, they're not only safe for us, but also safe for our pets as well. And that's very interesting. I mean, I've had dogs that have had lead poisoning that have been seizuring for that. People that have been doing remodeling and not realizing that they had lead-based paint in their house. So, those are not as common as some of the other reasons that I mentioned earlier, but thank you for bringing that up. And toxin exposure is usually something that we talk about as well when we're doing our history to try to figure out what's going on with the patient.
And thank you very much for calling. Gwen emailed us and wonders, in your experience, how successful are vigilant, educated dog owners in rehabilitating a dog with fear aggression? I've been reading books, going to dog classes, considering using a remote trainer so the dog doesn't become afraid of me, as in a correction. He's a rescued dog, about a year old, had him since October. He's easily frightened, and I've had to be very gentle with him and careful not to scare him too much. He bites friends and strangers' feet as they pass by. He growls at my sister, who's been there 25 times.
Oh, my goodness.
He really dislikes men, kind and gentle with our immediate family members. At first, he tried to protect his food. Now, with training, he doesn't show any aggression or growling since the training, giving him treats out of our hand as we approach him and his filled food dish. I'm worried about our liability, particularly in the future when we think he's better. If we seem to have him rehabilitated and it's 3 years down the road, will he revert back to old bad behaviors or with consistency and the same life, good life, will he be cured?
Oh, you know, I tell people that we will never cure a problem like this, that we can control it. And if they're looking for a cure where they can just kind of let their guard down and have a dog that they can trust, it'll probably never happen. In fact, even the best dogs in the world can still run into troubles. And so, you know, an owner always has to be watchful of the situation that the dog's being put in. My experience with using shock collars as a way, when you say remote training, it's probably just going to increase the dog's insecurity and fear. It is so difficult to use these effectively and yet not make a dog that is going to be, you know, more problematic. So I'd be careful about using that. I think your best bet is working with an applied animal behaviorist and going through a desensitization and counter-conditioning program that can be very long-standing, and it's not going to happen overnight, and it's going to take a lot of dedication. But by exposing him, let's say he, you know, doesn't like men. Well, maybe he likes short men over tall men better than, you know, tall men. Yeah. So get him exposed to, at a distance, while he's sitting and laying down and taking treats and relaxed, somebody off at the distance, and gradually having them come closer where, you know, they're then throwing treats and he's getting treats if he's food motivated. You gradually just keep expanding the number of things that, you know, you're letting him be exposed to. But just to, you know, throw him out there cold with, you know, lots of different people doesn't work. In fact, every time he bites, you yell, you scream, they scream. It's just going to increase the anxiety that this dog is feeling. And be really careful. Having a dog like this, you have to be careful about all your homeowner's liability insurance. There are some dogs that have actually been blackmailed by some insurance companies, you know, and usually they're the quote-unquote dogs that are the biters, like pit bulls and Dobermans and Rotties and Akitas and so on. But, you know, even if you have a dog that is not on that list, once you've had a couple of reported bites, you could lose your homeowner's insurance. So this dog truly is a liability. I would make sure that it has a basket muzzle on when it's out of your immediate attention so that it can't hurt anybody. And that will give you that safety feeling. You can, you know, get a basket muzzle, not the standard ones that vet clinics use to prevent the dog from biting for a quick procedure, but one that they, like a police dog would wear. They can actually pant and function and even take food treats through. That's what you're going to be looking for. And I would, even though it's admitting that, yes, my dog bites, you're going to be more relaxed, which will make the dog more relaxed.
Yeah. Well, dog bites now account for about a third of all homeowner insurance claims.
Yeah.
$350 million.
Yeah. It's a huge issue. And, you know, and it's not just these dogs. The number one dog for biting veterinarians is a Chihuahua. So, you know, that even the little dogs get in trouble. And, you know, and that's, you know, in my clinic, I have to agree with that. I mean, it's much easier to handle the bigger dogs than these little ones that are so fragile and don't like to have things done to them. So, this is where it comes down to having, you know, and this is so nice that this person's taken this dog in with that was a rescue. But, you know, if you get a dog, it needs to be well socialized. Make sure you're picking the right dog for you, avoiding mom or dad that have, you know, severe either extreme of being real, you know, real fearful or, you know, really assertive behaviors. Those tend to be highly heritable. You want a dog that has parents that are easygoing, and you want a puppy that's that way, that you can get out and socialize very early on in life. And remember, it's a lifetime thing to always keep them socialized.
Sandy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. I'm going to be back, I think, on the 11th of August.
11th of August. That's exactly right. Well, okay. We'll look forward to that visit. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. And it's always great to have her, and she'll be back on August 11th, and we'll do this once again. Just to take a look ahead, coming up tomorrow at 11 o'clock, we'll be talking about the birds of Wisconsin and migratory birds with Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator with the Department of Natural Resources. He's stationed at the Horican Marsh. And you can have your say even now on that program online at WPR.org. You can post comments now, during, or even now, or during the show, or after the show, as we talk with them about birds. Really easy to do. You just scroll down the page, the Wisconsin Public Radio page, WPR.org, and you'll come to the Ideas Network and WPR's new online community. Click on, and then you can join the process. We even have a little book prize for the person who emails in with the best comment for that particular show. So that's something coming up tomorrow. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.